This is the Medic Cast, December 7th, 2009.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the Medic Cast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the Medic Cast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to this week's show. Especially want to welcome all of the brand new listeners. We've got a lot of people checking out the show. They're wrapping up their semesters as students for paramedics or also students at EMTB programs. I've got a lot of inquiries about study aids and resources like that over the last few weeks. And that means to me that people are getting ready for testing. And so I want to welcome all of you and urge you to check out the information and additional resources you'll find over at the MedicCast blog. And that's mediccast.com/blog. Takes you to the blog site for this podcast. And you'll find links there for the show notes for this and every other episode and also other articles and information you'll find there. And I urge you to check out that information and find out what you can, what you need for your own studies. You can search the site there. You can go back and look at past podcast episodes. And really, I would urge you to look into all of the information you'll find linked there. And follow up. And if you have any comments or questions, you can leave comments right on the articles. You can also, of course, send in those emails. The address is podmedic@mac.com. You can also call in on the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. Quick moment here to shout out to my friends over at the Chronicles of EMS site, chroniclesofems.com. You can find a link there. If you're on Facebook, you can become a fan over on the Facebook page. Some exciting developments happened again this week. Zoll had already come in and sent a generous contribution to help get the Chronicles of EMS moving along. And they've gone to the next level, the next step. They've put together a site where you can sign up for more information on their cardiac monitoring system. So it's an email newsletter list. You can sign up and, you know, cancel at any time. But the advantage of doing that is that you can, for every person that signs up, they will donate $5 additionally to the Chronicles of EMS. So if you're looking for that, you can head over and find the link over on the chroniclesofems.com site. If you follow me on Twitter or any of my associates there on Twitter, we've been tweeting about this and sending that link out. So you can definitely find that link. And I would urge you to head over there. And for the cost of a few minutes and getting onto an email newsletter list there to find out more about cardiac monitoring, and that's a learning activity as well as anything else, you can have $5 sent as that aggregate numbers come in. That $5 will be sent per person over to the over to Chronicles VMS to continue to support that project. And I want to thank Zoll for doing that. You know, anybody else out there, and if you've got a business in the EMS or medical sector and you want to lend a hand, there's information over at chroniclesofems.com on how to do that. I get nothing from this. This is a group of friends. I think it's one of the most exciting projects to come along in EMS in a long while. And I think that this is just the beginning of a whole new opportunity for us to present what we do, not just to each other, but to the world, and do so in a format that everybody understands, good, high-quality TV. So let's cross our fingers, keep this project moving along, and do what we can to support it. Getting the listener email right now, and I got an email in from one of our good friends down in Australia, our good friend Flo down there, and Flo is a he. We're not going to make that mistake again. So see, Florian, I've got it figured out. So anyway, he sent in a link to a story from New South Wales. A woman is claiming that the ambulance got lost on the way to responding to her husband's to her call that her husband was having chest pain or cardiac incident, and that he died before they got there, and that she had started CPR. He was still alive. Well, we all know that she shouldn't be doing CPR if he was still alive. But I think that what she means is that, you know, she had started. He was alive when she made the call. The service is saying it was a 28-kilometer journey. They made it in 18 minutes, which was a 24-minute response from the time when she initially called into them, and they're claiming there was no delay. She says they got lost because they didn't have a GPS in their ambulance, and that's how they got turned around and got messed up in their directions. You know, this kind of thing is going to happen. And you know, unfortunately, unless we've got an ambulance parked across the street from your house, there is by default going to be some delay from when you call 911 or call 999 or whatever your service is. And between the time when you initiate that call and the time when an ambulance or paramedic or a chase vehicle or somebody shows up on your doorstep. And I think that this is, you know, okay, we're back into educate the public mode, but we should let people know how long it takes us to get from, you know, from our station or what our average response time is. And maybe this is something that people should understand when they are living in an area that if you live in certain regions, you're going to be out of the way from where the optimal ambulance coverage is. And I don't know, maybe that opens up a whole nother issue. Not sure, but it certainly is something interesting. And I want to thank Flo for sending that link in to me. Got an email in as well from listener Justin. And Justin wanted to check in and send me a link about a letter or a link he found about the King Airway. And this is linked over at defrance.org. If you haven't checked out defrance.org, you should definitely do so. EMS House of DeFrance is a great site based in New Jersey, I believe. And they do a good job of presenting some EMS information and news over time. So you should check it out. But there's an article over there, the FDA giving the King Airway a warning to that company, and it has to do with some non-approved uses they talk about on their website, including use in emergency care situations. Not an approved use, according to the FDA letter. I don't think this is something that's going to pull the King Airway off the market. I think it's one of those slap on the wrists from the Food and Drug Administration because they didn't get specific approval. I know we're considering the use of the King Airway in Maryland as we try to get away from the CombiTube. CombiTube still uses latex in its balloon, in the pharyngeal balloon that it uses, and they don't have a non-latex version of that. So we are looking at moving to the King Airway, and this is saying that the FDA has not approved it for use in emergent situations, only under situations where the patient is under anesthesia in a controlled situation in the facility for short durations. And certainly we have short durations, hopefully, but we're not under anesthesia or in a facility. And so this may not be an option for us. We'll have to see. Justin, I thank you for sending me a link. I didn't know about this, and we'll follow up on it. And I'll put a link to this in the show notes as well. I also heard from Greg Fries over via a Twitter conversation we had recently with one of our Twitter followers who wanted to hear some more information about pediatric assessment and pediatric patients. And, you know, it's something I think we can do. Greg and I are talking about doing a short segment here on the MedicCast and then following up with an EMS boot camp. One of those, you know, 1 hour to 1.5 hour segments, which are online webinars that are recorded and then available for people that have signed up for them. But we're going to do a whole segment on pediatric patients over at the EMS Bootcamp. And, you know, this all started via a Twitter request from one of our followers. So if you aren't following me over at Twitter, you can probably guess how easy it is to find me over at Twitter or Facebook. You can check me out over there, twitter.com/podmedic or facebook.com/podmedic. And definitely check out the MedicCast fan page. You know, my goal is to maybe get this, I'd like to try to get this fan page up over 1,000 listeners, because or 1,000 fans. When we do that, it actually will give me some additional functionality through Facebook. So, but I can't do that until I have 1,000 fans. We have about 350 fans or so right now. Let's, you know, anything you can do to encourage your friends that are on Facebook to become fans of the Medicast, let's see if we can drive those numbers up. So if you're on Facebook and you haven't become a fan of the Medicast, head over to Medic to the Facebook page. You can find the link on the Medicast blog right there, or you can just search for Medicast in the Facebook search field, and it should take you right there. So anybody who wants to help out in that way, it's greatly appreciated. Or just follow me on Twitter and make your requests over there as well. Let's jump on into this week's news. And in the news this week, we're going to look at one of the stories. A couple of them actually have a lot to do with costs and tightening of budgets that we're seeing in governments around the country. I think indeed in many parts of the world right now. And those tightened budgets are trickling down to affect public safety and EMS. And so I found some good articles and discussions on that for the news this evening, and thought I'd bring two of those in the beginning, two articles here. First one comes from Spotsylvania County, Virginia, and they have a Fire and Emergency Medical Services Commission that reviews things like their volunteer services as well as their paid services. And they have a system right now where nights and weekends are staffed almost entirely by volunteers, and three of their nine ambulances are able to be fully ALS crews. The other six are BLS crews. And the discussion is being presented, how much would it cost to upgrade all of those other six units to ALS units, and is it really needed? And I think this is going to be a discussion that is brought up in many, many areas, because I think we need to all face the facts that how many of our calls really require ALS care? How many of our calls have an ALS provider show up and maybe they start an IV and hook them up to a heart monitor, but they didn't need any other interventions all the way to the hospital? Now, obviously, chest pain calls, serious traumas and things like that are going to necessitate some ALS oversight. But, you know, in many cases, a lot of these patients could be transported by BLS crews. And I think that that's what this commission is looking at in Spotsylvania County, Virginia. They're looking at how much it would cost to upgrade to that level. And they're looking at it costing their county budget $3.1 million, a third of their total rescue and fire budget, to increase the ALS to the ALS level, these other ambulances, and staff them. And so this is something that I think is something we're going to be seeing everywhere. And if you've had something like this happen or discussions like this come up in your region, I'd love to see or hear from you. What is that causing to happen in your area? Have they made a decision? Have they decided that they don't need as many ALS units on 24/7? What's your thought on that? And of course, this is going to be an ongoing discussion. And it's, you know, the discussion of so many services require training to paramedic, especially dual service fire EMS services, where they have requirement for a certain engine firefighters on the engines, some of them to be trained to paramedic level, even though they're not going to ride on the ambulance. And you know, the cost of having additional paramedics and the equipment that goes with them on these engines could be construed as an extreme extra cost and not necessary in all cases. So it's going to be something that's an ongoing discussion, and I think it's something that we all should be prepared for and should really examine the call volume we have and the types of calls that we're likely to face, and do some shaking up of the budget a little bit, shaking up of the way we staff our ambulances, and seeing what would really work best for our region rather than what we'd like to have. And sometimes those things are two different items. I also found another story here looking at some other budgetary items. This is from Alabama, and this is an organization, the Huntsville Emergency Medical Services, Inc., HEMSI, is one of the regional emergency services providers in Alabama, and they get budgetary funding from the state to engage in training and resources, providing training and resources for the EMS services in their each of their regions. And the a recent legislative committee looking at the budget has cut $20,000 from the budgets of this emergency medical service oversight committee or regional provider for emergency medical services. Now, they did want to say that they're bringing in $252,000 a year, that cutting that $20,000 is less than 10% of their budget, and that this budgetary money is supposed to be used for training and things like that, but that they should be able to make do, according to one of the quotes from the legislature, with this funding cut. The quote says, quote, they should be able to function. They're not starving by any means. And I'm thinking we're going to be seeing more of this as well, that maybe we aren't cutting ALS services in favor of BLS services, but we are going to see some cutting in training budgets. And we're going to have to be, as training officers in some regions, be much more inventive and creative with our ability to engage training for our providers. We may not be able to send them to conferences that are at a distance where they might have to stay overnight. We might have to look at the cost of, you know, it might be more cost effective to bring somebody in to teach from one of these conferences rather than sending providers to these conferences. And, you know, that costs a trip at a distance, especially if plane flight is involved, could cost over $1,000 for a weekend trip or a couple of day trip to a conference, whereas that's for one person. You could bring in someone and do a training session for 20 to 30 people at the cost of $150 to $200 a person and have a very qualified and highly entertaining speaker and in your own region come in and teach in your area. And I think that that might be something, a trend that we see happening more and more frequently. It's something that people like myself and Greg Fries and some others that do some teaching in different areas around us could be seeing us, you know, traveling to other areas in at more of a distance because of the cost effectiveness of bringing someone in rather than sending a bunch of people to a conference at a distance. Cheaper to bring one person in and pay the travel fees than it is to pay for everybody's travel fees. And I think that that's something we're likely to see. But I just thought I'd point this out. And I really do want to hear back from you. Have you seen evidence of cuts in your training budget? Or have you seen some of the discussions regarding ALS versus BLS services? I definitely want to hear from you and make sure you get back in touch with me. Again, the email address is podmedic@mac.com, or you can call in on the voicemail line 941-306-3342-94130-MEDIC. And love to hear from you and see what you guys are seeing out there in the field. I'm going to wrap up the news today with a story out of D.C. D.C. EMS made the news again. We've been discussing this, all heck, for the last 4 years of the show, I guess, talking about some of the issues that Washington, D.C.'s EMS service has had. Now, in Washington, D.C., the EMS is a subset of the fire services, fire department there. And in years past, there seemed to be some second-class citizen treatment going on where they just weren't really focusing on EMS care. It was, you know, considered maybe a punishment to be assigned to the EMS unit, or you worked on the ambulance as a way to work your way onto a piece of fire equipment, and you had to pay your dues on the ambulance first. And so it became, you know, a lesser position than the fire department positions, rather than an equal position or even a more important position. Because let's face it, EMS runs a lot more calls than fire systems do with a lot fewer man hours, but we have all these firefighters that have to be maintained because you've got to have a fully staffed engine, and they might get half or a third of the calls in call volume. So DC's been facing this issue, and they've really had some problems. I think, and we've pointed out in the past that I see it as a leadership issue. I really do. I think this type of institutional bias against EMS is a top-down problem. It comes from the fire chief. If the fire chief is supportive and positive about EMS service and requires training and expertise and support and assistance to EMS providers to get their jobs done, then the other firefighters under them will follow that lead. And so if you got an institutional bias in one way or the other, that certainly is coming down from the upper management levels. And we've seen this year after year. Seems like, I think in the 4 years I've been covering it, we've seen three or four different medical directors, physicians that have been medical directors in EMS service, come in and go out because and citing issues where they were coming head to head with fire services and upper management regarding things that they these doctors felt should be done in the EMS field. And, you know, that's sounds like managed care and insurance, doesn't it? Anyway, what we're talking about here is this particular article that just came up is that another medical director has resigned. This appears to be for reasons of medical problems with the doctor involved and not problems with the service itself, according to this article. Now, heck, this is Washington, D.C. This could be, you know, he's leaving for medical reasons, quote unquote, maybe could be, you know, code for we're having a problem here and we're not going to resolve it. So we're going to leave for medical reasons. But I don't think that's the case because in other situations, it seems like it's been very vocal and very, very well publicized if there's been an issue. And I haven't seen that in this particular situation. So the bad news is if they've got a medical director and a fire chief that can work well together, and this medical director is going to leave, that leaves, it leaves a hole again where EMS may not be supported adequately by a medical director in the near future in DC, where they might have had one for the last 17 months or so. So we'll have to wait and see. But I this is an ongoing unfolding story over the last 4 years as the city and the nation's capital struggles to resolve some of their issues with emergency medical care. And I'm hopeful that they'll be able to get another medical director in there that's doing a good job and able to work with the fire service management and to institute policies that will enable the EMS system in DC to continue to grow. We'll have to wait and see, but I certainly would hope that trend continues. Time for this week's tip and trick of the week. And the tip of the week this week comes courtesy of a good friend of mine, Greg. Greg Reardon, he was a paramedic instructor, one of the instructors when I was going through my paramedic program a few years back. And I put out a call on Facebook Friday afternoon when I was starting to record this episode and was like, oh, you know, I haven't picked a tip of the week yet this week. Somehow it had just slipped my mind and thought I had done it already and got ahead of myself. And so I got a bunch of people responding back to me on Facebook, facebook.com/podmedic, and a bunch of my friends over there, including Greg, sent some ideas back, all of them really good ideas. And so I thought I would continue on with some of these ideas, maybe use them in future tips. But the one I selected for this week came from Greg, and it is talking about STEMI. Imitators, STEMI imitators, ST elevation, MI. Okay. So what are we talking about here? This is ST segment elevation and myocardial infarction. What imitates that? What kind of EKG readings might we see that we would think is a STEMI, but is actually presenting, is actually something else. And Greg came up with that idea, and I appreciate it. And I thought it was something we haven't touched on. I haven't done much on EKGs on the show here recently, so let's talk a little bit about you know misdiagnosing some of these things in ST elevation MIs. Now I'm going to preface this with a statement, and I urge you to chime in yourselves if you disagree or agree with me. But one of the things I think we need to be very careful about is questioning a suspected MI in the field and making a decision about where to take that patient if we're not sure if it's an MI, even though we might see signs of ST elevation. We should be able to read our 12 leads. We definitely should be competent and skilled, and we should understand some of these imitators and understand how our protocols affect where we go. But we should involve online medical control, and we should err on the side of caution. I would rather take a patient with a false positive for MI into a cath lab rather than err on the other side and take a patient who has a false negative sign of MI, take them to the local hospital where they aren't close enough to a cath lab and thrombolytics aren't working and the patient ends up dying or developing significant disability as a result of prolonged MI. And so there's a lot of things that go into this. And so I just want to point out that I think that in any effect, when we're doing a 12 lead on a patient that's presenting with other signs and symptoms of myocardial infarction, you know, chest pain, unstable angina, patients that are not responding well to other treatments, severe diaphoresis, anxiety, you know, we know what the signs are, then we should be treating that accordingly. And following our acute coronary syndrome protocols and also utilizing cardiac centers appropriately in our region. And, you know, I'd rather take we need to err on the side of the patients. We need to be conservative in these diagnoses. Got some good links for this particular segment, and I'm going to urge you to follow up on those links. I'm going to touch on some things here that are explained much better in the links I've provided you, including a couple of journal articles and a transcript of an online presentation, including pictures of the slides from the presentation that is a downloadable PDF that has a lot of great information and is aimed at physicians and medical directors, but talks a lot about how EMS fits into that picture. And I think that it's a valuable tool to show you what's going on and give you an idea of the mindset and how decisions are made about where patients should be taken and how conservative or not we should be. But let's look at ST segment abnormality in patients. Now, this was a American Journal of Emergency Medicine 2001 at a study called Cause of ST Segment Abnormality in ED Chest Pain Patients. And this was put out by retrospective ECG review of an adult chest pain patient that presented in a university hospital emergency department. So this particular article, if you look at it, just goes through and it's summarized in one of the posts I have. What's the number one cause of that chest pain and supposed ST elevation? Well, 25% of the cases were exhibiting left ventricular hypertrophy. What's that? Enlarged left side of the heart. This is a heart problem, an issue that is as a result of people that have had perhaps an aortic valve disorder or people that have had prolonged, untreated high blood pressure where that left side of the heart is having to compensate for inability to pump effectively. So this was showing ST segment elevation simply because the left side of the heart was unusually large. How are you going to know that in the field? Probably it's going to be difficult to diagnose. Left bundle branch blocks accounted for 15%. Well, I know in my protocols, I can't make a call if I have a bundle branch block at all, left or right. I can't call it ST segment elevation. I have to have a narrow complex QRS complex with ST segment elevation and before I can say I have a possible STEMI. And so I can rule out, according to this article, 20% of the false positives if I just disregard anything that presents as a bundle branch block. Remember, bundle branch blocks are wide QRS segments. Most people say that they should be wider than 0.12 seconds and that those bundle branch, that shows a prolonged depolarization of the ventricles and is a sign of blockages in the bundle branches. Some patients, about 12% in this study, presented with benign early repolarization, okay? And this means that it's showing signs of ST segment elevation because their ventricles are repolarizing. The cells are resetting to be ready for another contraction faster than expected. They're resetting very quickly. And it's benign, but it shows up as ST elevation. Again, we're going to see that ST elevation anytime there seems to be an increased electrical activity going on. And so we need to think about why that might be occurring. And those would be our false positives. There was also some things like non-specific bundle branch blocks. So you have wide QRS, but you're not sure why. Accounts for another 5%. We had people with some aneurysms, pericarditis, and unknown or unknown causes in 17% of the cases. So those could have, but what they're looking at here is people that came in were treated for chest pain, a suspected ST elevation myocardial infarction, STEMIs, but when they looked at the labs and got back all the blood work and everything, they saw no signs of cardiac markers in the blood work. And because of that, they ruled it out as a cardiac event. It was not an MI. It was something else that was causing the ST elevation. And, you know, heck, 17% of the other causes that were talked about here were unknown, undefined, which leads me to wonder, where are those other 17? How many of them might have been MIs? Now, one interesting thing that's pointed out in a couple of the articles is that how many of these patients were patients who, well, I mean, let's see, did they get treated prior to hospital? Did they have aspirin administered? Did they have other treatments administered, such as nitroglycerin and possibly morphine for chest pain? These are all vasodilators. We could have pushed the blockage away. We could have moved the block in the coronary artery so that it self resolved, or the patient had it self resolve. This is something that can happen, and so these patients should have shown up with cardiac markers, but if it didn't last long enough, maybe they didn't present in high enough numbers to be detected. So this is something to consider as well. But it's you need to talk with your medical directors, and you need to talk with your training officers, and ask them to explain your STEMI protocol. Sit down and help you understand how they want you to think in your decision-making process. You know, this is a collaborative effort. And one of the things I think that every one of these articles that I've looked at passes down is that handling any kind of MI, ST elevation or non-ST elevation MIs, are part of a team process. That certainly it is very important to reduce the quote-unquote door to balloon time, and we're part of that process. The sooner we can identify a possible STEMI, the sooner the medical team can get a hold of our 12 lead, look at it, and make a decision. If we're making a mistake, if we're misdiagnosing an ST elevation MI, then we can certainly take that. You know, I'd rather, like I said, err on the caution, side of caution for a patient. But these are decisions and discussions you can have with your medical director and really find out from them where they want you to think, where they want you to have your head when you're coming at a patient with a suspected MI. And I think that this is all part of that team process, because usually that medical director is part of a local hospital system, and that medical director might be one of your ER docs, is going to see the patients you bring in on occasion, and you should have a good working relationship with them, because they're going to have to make a decision once they get this patient themselves on whether to pass them on up the chain. And a lot of the research I've seen is that, you know, they're ER docs that are making this call, and they're making calls for false negatives and false positives, where they're keeping a patient that should be transported to a cath lab, as well as transporting patients. So this isn't just a mistake that's being made in the EMS field. This is across the board. And I think that one of the reasons this is having so much attention drawn to it in recent years is because we've gotten better at getting these patients to the hospital. We've gotten better at picking cath labs and identifying possible MIs. And so now they have a large number of false positives to look at. And it doesn't mean we're going to change a whole lot about what we do, but it might mean that we refine our criteria. And that's why I say, you know, you should work with your training officers, review your 12 lead protocols, review what your system wants you to do, and where your different facilities are. Some patients might be better candidates for thrombolytics, and if you don't administer them in the field, they can be given at the hospital. And so if your patient's a candidate for thrombolytics and your cath lab's at a distance, it might be better to get them in and start thrombolytics on these patients and see how they respond. And this is going to be, again, a decision that's made at the medical director's level. But certainly you should understand how that process works. So, you know, this is a discussion, kind of a tip that's not so much of a concrete tip, is more of an ongoing discussion. And I really welcome your your comments back to me. This is something I think that we all can learn a lot about how each of us, each of our systems deals with this problem. And that's one of the things that we can all work together on. So send me your comments back, how you guys deal with STEMIs in your region, how you are changing the way you deal with this. Have you had a discussion about false positives? And let's continue to bring this out and discuss these things. In any event, I really enjoy hearing from you. So again, send emails in to podmedic@mac.com. You can also call in on the voicemail line and catch up with the MedicCast there. An even better way to do that is if you have information, or perhaps you're a training officer yourself and would like to share some ideas from your own STEMI programs with the rest of the MedicCast community, you can leave that information in a comment right below the show notes for this episode. Just click on the comments button. There's a button at the top of every article or at the bottom, and leave those comments for the rest of the community here at MedicCast. And you know what? That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to remind you to check out mediccast.com/blog. That's the show notes pages and other articles posted over there every week. And so you can go right there, right at the top of the page. You'll see a link for show notes. You can click on that and go right to the most recent show notes for each episode. And then you can go back in time and look at past episodes as well. All of the links for the news items and the tip discussions are provided for you there. If you'd like to get in touch with me, you can reach me here by email. Send those emails in to podmedic@mac.com. You can also call in on the voicemail line. I'd love to hear from you on the voicemail line, especially, you know, call in about your STEMI protocols. I'd love to hear you guys talking about that. Call in on the voicemail line. Again, it's 941-306-3342. 941-30-MEDIC is the voicemail line here at the MedicCast. And of course, you can always leave comments as well over at the MedicCast blog. Okay, enough of me talking. Let's wrap up the show. We've got some holiday music here as we're in December, and we're going to have some holiday music all the way through the holidays, courtesy of me. You get to listen to these, and you can always just go to the end and go to the next podcast you're listening to. But I always like to bring these things out there, and there's some good PodSafe music, some good music from some very good performers and artists out there. And this week is no different. I have Jeff Smith, who has produced a lot of music we played here on the show, and will continue to do so. This is his Christmas song, one of his Christmas songs called Some Christmas Huggin' and Kissin'. So if you like what you hear, you can head over and check out Jeff's website, all of his great music, The Jeff Smith, and that's G-E-O-F-F Smith.com, TheJeffSmith.com. And there'll also be a link with a button on it that you can go check out this song at iTunes. You know, 99 cents, download this song and support Jeff and his providing good independent music for podcasters. You know, it's a 99 cents well spent, and it'll show these artists that we support them as well. So you'll find that link in the show notes, and I urge you to support him. Anyway, we're going to head into Jeff's song, and I will close out, as I always do, reminding you that I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and don't forget, folks, scene safety, BSI.
Dropping, and again I'm all alone out walking tonight. I used to have a spring in my step, but now something is missing, and I know it's not right. Last year I was good, and oh jolly Saint Nick was true to his word. I was the top of the list of all those who were blessed, but this year I don't know. I give back those toys and gadgets and knickknacks that he left under the tree. Don't need the sweater and the jacket and the eggnog. I've had it and it's no good for me. This year I've been thinking that I don't need a thing you could hide in a box, it's true. 'Cause all I want for Christmas is some hugging and some kissing from you. I'd give up my iPod Shuffle or my BlackBerry. I don't need to make any calls. No, don't need my sling box, baby. You could call me crazy. I don't watch it at all. The magic bullet, the toaster, or the thing that makes the roast beef I saw on TV.
or my brand new Fender Telecaster. It don't mean nothing to me. No, I give back those toys and gadgets and knickknacks that he left under the tree. Don't need the sweater and the jacket and the eggnog. I've had it and it's no good for me. This year I've been thinking that I don't need a thing. You can hide in a box, it's true. All I want for Christmas is some hugging and some kissing from you. Yeah, you know what to do. So come on, baby, don't leave me blue. And I'll be here. Let's start something new. And knickknacks that he left under the tree. Don't need the sweater and the jacket and the eggnog. I've had it and it's no good for me. This year I've been thinking that I don't need a thing. You can hide in a box, it's true. 'Cause all I want for Christmas is some hugging and some kissing and some squeezing and some loving and some sweet turtle doving. All I ever wanted on my Christmas morning was you. All I want for Christmas is you, baby.